The following is Mike Atherton's talk, Beyond the Polar Bear, from the 2011 Information Architecture Summit. The 2011 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's User Experience Training Library, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. Hear the field's top experts on timely topics and the current design challenges you're facing. Get a free UIE virtual seminar at uie.com/IAS11.
Okay, folks, they want us to kick this off and get them going on time, so we're going to do that. Good morning. So again, welcome. Last day of the summit. I hope everybody's had a good time so far. Woo-hoo. Come on, folks. 8:30 did not mean 8:30-ish.
Sharp.
So I'm Adam Polansky, usual suspect around the IA Summit for a while. Spare random helper, bottle washer, and whatever else happening is getting done. And today I have the pleasure of introducing Mike Atherton from the BBC. So he's going to talk about a number of things. I've had the privilege of getting to preview some of the things he's talking about. Get your notepads out, because this is really good, really dense stuff, maybe even a little controversial. So you know, be ready to go. So without much more ado, ladies and gentlemen, Mike Atherton.
Thanks, Adam. Good morning, and thanks all for coming this morning. I know it's really early. For the past 13 years or so, the Polar Bear book by Lew Rosenfeld and Peter Morville has been an invaluable constitution for our industry. Maybe this morning we'll be drafting a few amendments to that constitution. Did you see a lot's happened in the past 13-odd years? Google happened, Facebook and Twitter happened, smartphones happened, IPTV happened. So the routes to content have become more organic and ubiquitous. Today we'll be looking at how the BBC make websites that best fit their content offering, that better fit how the web is today, and deliver on the mission that they've had since 1922 to inform, educate, and entertain. Now, I should say, my colleague, Michael Smethurst, who should be sitting here, can't make it today, unfortunately, but he's very much here in spirit. And when we get to the science bits, it's all him. So, the Polar Bear book teaches us that information is hard to categorize. In many ways, taxonomic site design hasn't really moved on from the library science model of one physical book having to fit on one physical shelf. In more recent years, we've done things like tagging to expose more facets of content and thus unlock more user journeys. But really, as information architects, we're pretty much limited to saying that one thing is more or less specific than another thing. And so, you know, we do our card sorts and we label our boxes and we make our site maps and hope that the categories that we lay out in our homepage will give some clue as to the goodies within. And then we get frustrated in user testing sessions when we find that people aren't coming to the homepage at all, but in fact deep linking to the content from Google. Now, the BBC has a bit of a problem. No one really knows whether to talk about the website, singular, or websites, plural. In theory, the website is bbc.co.uk, but in fact, web presences have popped up over the years like tents on a hillside. Because the BBC is massive. It has 8 national TV stations, 10 national radio stations, 40-odd local radio stations, and collectively they put out between 1,000 and 1,500 programs every day. So it's been really difficult, therefore, for such a large organization to represent its offering properly online. And there have been various sort of cultural and political and technical hurdles to overcome. Consequently, they've ended up building a web presence in just about the most inefficient and expensive way possible. Siloed teams, hand cranking out pages, creating lots of repetition across the business, pages that aren't linked to and so have terrible SEO, pages that get mothballed, whatever the hell that means, when a program isn't on air anymore, or removed from the web completely, throwing these rather nasty 404 errors. And recently, they've been making this sort of government-appeasing diktat to reduce the number of top-level directories on their site by half, which is a bit weird for something that's supposed to be one website. and a bit embarrassing for the world's favorite broadcaster. This year also they've pledged to reduce their online spend by 25%. That's going to lead to a major loss of resource and consequently force them into a more efficient way of publishing content. Now, at the BBC also, and arguably beyond, the grey squirrel of user experience design is busy gnawing the legs off the red squirrel of information architecture. The focus is now quite squarely on the presentational and interaction elements of user experience. And we get service design projects that start with very, very beautiful, but largely imaginary mock-ups. Perhaps even here in Denver today, in a great metropolitan company, a senior executive is being wowed by a Photoshop comp that may or may not be buildable. The perception is that rapid prototyping, by which I mean faked up prototypes, are cheaper and easier to develop than anyone getting their hands dirty with actual code. So these things get incubated in a vacuum, which, come to think of it, isn't really healthy for anybody. UX design and product decisions get really made implicitly up front before anything's been put in front of the user, or even before software engineers have been consulted as to the art of the possible. So at the BBC, this whole web thing needed a bit of a rethink, and some rebel forces striking from a hidden base have won their first victory against the evils of siloed thinking. They recognize the power of the semantic web and how it could be used to build bridges between content, extend user journeys, and stitch all of the BBC's offering into a single, extensible framework. So think about this. When we're doing some heavy IA, we're trying to think about how our subject breaks down, but at the same time, we're trying to think about how our web pages are going to be organized. We're like librarians finding boxes to put things in, so we might do a card sort and then end up with, you know, a box for videos and a box for news and a box for photos. A couple of problems here. One is that, as we know, information doesn't really fit into boxes very neatly. The relationships between things are much richer and more graph-like than just saying broader and narrower. And the second problem is that when we think about our favorite subject, we're not really thinking about documents at all. We're thinking about things. Yes, things, real-world things. Now, the last summit I was here at, I spoke about Disney theme parks. So it's as good as an example as any. Disney World is a real place. It lives in a real location, and it has a number of theme parks within it. Each of those theme parks is divided into a number of lands, and as any Disney fan knows, each of them has their own iconic weenie. The lands contain a number of attractions, and those attractions will have been created by someone and may, in some cases, be based on some prior art, like a movie. The resorts also have resorts, which is a slightly weird Disneyism. Let's call them hotels. And hotels have restaurants. And in fact, the lands also have restaurants, so let's join that line up too. The restaurants have meals, and indeed, meals can be associated with characters. This is Disney after all. And indeed, those characters can be based on some piece of prior art. So quite quickly, you get a rich, interconnected graph of things, and the relationships between them are very important to define. So in looking to represent a subject online, we think first about those things and relationships long, long before we ever think about making web pages. At the BBC, this book, Domain-Driven Design, has become the new Bible. It proposes not a taxonomic, but an ontological way of modeling subject domains, called, appropriately enough, a domain model. And it's really just an attempt to capture a user's mental model about a subject, identifying the important things and the relationships between them. Domain modeling has become the first step in a process of building new web products at the BBC that has seen us move away from starting from wireframes and Photoshop comps to starting with a logical model of the subject we're trying to capture. So what does it look like? Well, this is a simple domain model that was done around the Champions League soccer tournament. It defines how each soccer match in the middle there. It fits into the rounds of a competition. Each match would be held in a stadium. Hopefully, not always, there's some goals attached to it, which would be scored by a player who belongs to a team. Again, you can see the important things defined and the lines joining them up. How do we do it? Well, when we're creating these domain models, the first people we go to are the people who really know their onions. Not necessarily technical people, but subject experts, or as we call them, domain experts. We ask them lots of questions, and we try and uncover the hidden complexities about a subject. And then after that, we go to the end users. They might have a simpler or just different view of the world, different languages that they might use to describe things. But in a sense, the users' view of the world is the more important one, because after all, they'll be the people who are Googling your content and hoping it conforms to their mental model. Now, we know from all those card sorting exercises we've done over the years that labeling things is hard. And actually defining conceptual differences between things is even harder. I like Wuthering Heights. But what do I mean by that? That I like the book, or maybe I like a movie version I've seen, or maybe I even like the Kate Bush song? I do, actually. If it's the book, am I thinking of a specific edition of the book? Because actually all of these things are different things, but they could be said to be Wuthering Heights. Or maybe it's the overall concept of Wuthering Heights, if you like, a sort of masterwork that's distinct from any specific manifestation. So we find that in mapping a mental model, some things are more difficult to quantify than others. And outside of domain experts, users can struggle to label things appropriately, even if they understand the inherent differences between, say, the Beatles' Rubber Soul album and all of the other things that could be said to be the same thing. But defining the damn things is vital if you want to be able to point to them. I would expect that most people looking to buy a copy of Wuthering Heights are thinking in general terms about the novel. They're not really thinking of a specific edition. But if they're Googling for Amazon results, for example, well, Amazon don't really have a concept of Wuthering Heights in a general sense. To them, two different editions of Wuthering Heights are as different as a copy of Wuthering Heights and a copy of Pride and Prejudice. And so when you do Google that, you get a whole bunch of Amazon results back, which splinters their Google juice and really isn't as good for them as having some sort of master aggregation would be. Plus they've had, and you've probably seen this on Amazon, they've had to put various hacks in place to merge things together. So when you're on the Blu-ray version of a movie page, you'll get reviews complaining about the DVD version and stuff, because really those two things are different things. So when we're trying to model a concept, we think very hard about what the canonical version of each thing that we're trying to describe is. But the good news is that when making a domain model, you don't have to get it right first time. The domain-driven process is very heavy on iteration, right down to this fundamental level. But once you've got this sort of shared model and understanding of your subject and a shared lexicon to describe it, you end up with a consistent user experience that's sort of baked in from the ground up. Now, domain modeling is a big deal, and it's probably really bigger than we've been able to go through in this quick run-through today. That domain-driven design book is a coffee table read. It could even be a coffee table. But hopefully that's given you a little bit of an idea of the principles that UBC have put into practice. Let's look at that practice now, first with a site that realized a long-held ambition for the BBC, which was a way to have a persistent web presence for every one of those 1,500 programs that are going out every day. TV is a very messy business, and it was never really designed to be put into much order. Sometimes one-off shows become the pilot for a series. Sometimes schedulers will decide that a two-part episode in the middle is like a mini-series within a series. When we think of a show in general, like Glee or The Wire or Silent Witness here, that's what TV people, or the BBC people, would call a brand. And it's a different thing from any specific season of that show. Actually, Silent Witness is a bit weird because it has sub-series within it, that those kind of two or three episode arcs. And within that, obviously, there are episodes. But even episodes come in different versions, like ones that come with sign language. Sherlock is a show that was very popular last year. I think it's been over here too and been popular as well. It's only had 3 episodes. So currently it's not really defined as a series or a season. It's a brand that has some episodes attached right now. How would that change if there was more Sherlock made, as I believe there will be? Well, it could be that they tack on extra episodes and make what has gone before all of series 1. Maybe. More likely, they'd start again with series 2. But even that changes things, because now your brand sits above that and you've got an extra level to your hierarchy that you didn't have before. And it's this kind of change that the program teams have had to deal with in modeling their site. So by talking to schedulers, they came up with this. So this is the program's domain model. Again, you can see that it describes the important things and the relationships between them. At the top of the tree is the brand. This is a show like Doctor Who, let's say. And Doctor Who has a number of series, and I'm sure Martin will know. I mean, that gets very complicated depending on whether you start counting in 1963 or 2005. Each series has a number of episodes, and as we saw, each episode has a number of versions, all of which have been either broadcast at some time or available on demand at some time. Collectively, we call these things programs, and they would have a format, such as drama, and a genre, such as science fiction, and they go out on services, which was a way to sort of munge together the idea of TV channels and radio networks. So this was the domain model that they started with, and then they had to sort of populate it with business data. And only then did they start thinking about actually creating web pages. But because of the things and relationships that had already been described, outputting a ton of web pages for all those domain objects became relatively straightforward. And for the first time in web history, a broadcaster had represented its entire output reliably, persistently, and scalably on the web. The approach generated one page per thing, one URL per program. Now, why is that important? Well, think for a second about the success of Wikipedia and how it's always at the top of your Google results. Wikipedia has many thousands of single pages, each of them discussing a single topic. Having a single URL makes it easy to point to that thing, and makes it therefore easy to link to, easy to blog about and tweet about and generally share. And internally, it means that content teams have a single point of focus to enhance with their multimedia niceties, and most important of all, it focuses all of the Google juice for that resource on a single URL, making it easy to find. Which brings me on to URL, URI design, which I think is a very important, though sadly often overlooked, part of user experience. We use some guiding principles in making nice web addresses. First off, they need to be persistent. In other words, they need to be reliably there all the time. Also, they need to be, or should be, hackable, which is the thing where, you know, you can sort of chop them back at the slashes to a higher order level of things. I'm sure we've all done that. And thirdly, they need to be human readable, if they can be, because that's just nice. But as this little hierarchy of needs triangle shows us, far and away the most important is persistence, because as our Lord above, Tim Berners-Lee, says, cool URIs don't change. Your web address is an implicit contract with the people who bookmark or linked to your site. But how do you maintain that kind of persistence in that messy world of TV that's always subject to a lot of change? Well, let's look at what we could have for a URL for a program. It could be something like this. I don't know if, can you all read that? Where we have, you know, all the information in there. That SHTML is not particularly nice. No one really cares about what technology we're using. And in fact, that might change over time. So let's get rid of that. So then, maybe that. A bit better. Series 1, though. Well, as we saw with the Sherlock example, we don't really even always know that it's Series 1, and that could change. I mean, it could change if it's going overseas or if more episodes are made. So let's get rid of that, too. Well, then we're left with that. BBC One is in there, which is one of the BBC's TV networks. That's not always true, though, because, you know, not only can a program jump from one network to another over its lifetime, but even the names of networks themselves can change. So we better get rid of that as well. Then we're left with that, which is nice and neat. Sherlock, episode one, makes sense. 10 radio stations, 8 TV stations, 40 local radio stations. What are the chances that at some point now or in the future there's another show called Sherlock? What if we use an example that was called The Breakfast Show or Drive Time? So we can't even be sure that that's unique. So now we're left with that, which is just bollocks. So in fact, the real URL leaves in just about the only thing we know for sure, that it's a program and that it can be individually identified. Now that only leaves us with a partly human readable URL, but we have made damn sure that it's going to be persistent. And so the program site launched with a whimper, quietly giving people a URL to link to for every one of those BBC programs, from the educational and worthy ones that make good use of our public funding, to the ones that people actually enjoy watching. Did it set the web alight? Well, not really, not at first, not outside the IA community, because while the modeling and all of that was a huge technical feat, really, as we know, content is still king. And when those pages first launched, aside from a few air dates and synopses and things like that, they were fairly light on delight. The team called it a skeleton in need of muscles and skin. But it soon got those muscles and skin because with a single point of focus, the program's content team were able to enhance those pages very quickly. First off, by embedding a copy of the program itself on the page, which is pretty cool, thanks to iPlayer, which is the BBC's equivalent of Hulu. And then things like production stills, clips, oh, and track listings, music track listings, which is very cool, the music that's played in a program, because they made those clickable and linked over to the BBC music domain where you could find out more about that artist. So program pages have now become the standard for representing program content online. Gone are the days of siloed teams making siloed microsites that were full of glory while the show was hot and left to wither while the show was not. In its place is this extensible framework that comprehensively represents the BBC's entire output. Still, people really do like those kind of microsites, don't they? So the program content teams have been given tools to skin and reconfigure program pages to make them more like microsites. And the experience is much the same. But rather than being siloed, they're stitched into this wider fabric. And we've even started to look at modeling the content within a program, such as characters and plot events and locations, with a view to recontextualizing stories beyond the confines of a 30 or 60 minute episode. But modeling programs was only the start of the story. Once you can point to programs and indeed bits of programs, then you've suddenly unlocked a whole wealth of AV content that you can use to make more cool stuff. Well, like this. BBC Food is another site or section. It was always doing okay, never doing that well. It's a recipe database, a bit like Epicurious, but justified by the fact that the BBC make a lot of cooking shows and people need to go somewhere to get the recipe. Well, I don't know about you, but if I'm looking for an apple crumble recipe, there's only one place that I go, and that's Google. I'll, you know, put in the search, and I'll get the first couple of results back, and I'll pick one, and that's fine. So SEO, therefore, is very, very important in a saturated recipes market. And frankly, the SEO for the BBC site, BBC Food site, wasn't that great. Oh, they had apple crumble, all right. Too bloody many of them. 280 results for apple crumble, which splintered the Google juice. So how, therefore, could SEO be improved and more routes to content be unlocked? Well, back to basics. We went back to the things that people think about. And in this case, also the things that we knew that people were searching for. Now, I'm a modern sensitive guy. You know, I reckon that men think about Nigella, while women think about chocolate. When he thinks Nigella, he's thinking chocolate cake. Sorry. And she's probably thinking about a cooking show that she saw this morning, which leads them to both think about a recipe. great minds, if you will, think alike. So those are the things that people are thinking about. How does that look as a domain model? Well, at its heart, you can see there's a recipe that was written by a chef that needs some ingredients, and there's some cool round tripping going on there, as you can see, because if you think about a recipe for something like chicken stock or corned beef, then once you've made it, it can become an ingredient in another recipe. There's techniques, like how to knead dough or how to scoop out lobster brains. And because this is the BBC, it's come from a TV show, a program. And then there's the all-important dish, which we'll come back to in a second. But think about this for a second. Recipes have quite a rich source of data. That's what I might be having for dinner tonight. But if you look at the content of a recipe, there's a whole lot going on in there, but usually it's sort of baked in as static, unexploitable text. Through applying these domain modeling techniques, the food team were able to make each ingredient and each technique a pointable thing. And so move the site, here it comes, from sources to resources. Thank you. By modeling around the structure of a recipe, they unlocked all these new routes to content. Show me all of Nigella's cupcake recipes, or tell me what I can do with this zucchini. And then back to the dish. And the dish is the most important thing. It's this idea of having a master canonical work, a mental image, if you will, of spaghetti bolognese, off of which individual recipes could be hung. The dish gave something for people to point at, consolidating all of the Google juice onto a single URL, and actually made things a bit more stable. Recipes are a little bit more rights managed than you might think, so even when a specific recipe had to be taken down, the canonical dish stood firm. So did it work? Well, yeah. This focus on unlocking new routes to content, along with a big push on very SEO-friendly language, massively boosted the internal link density of the site and made it easier for external linking. The result is that the traffic doubled, up to 1.3 million weeklies, 150,000 extra users every week from search, and now food has about 20% of the UK recipes market. But let's look at those users in a bit more detail and just ponder something else for a second. Last year, there was a 20% month-on-month rise in access from smartphones. It's now currently 10% of the entire traffic is from mobile devices. 70% of referrals are from Google directly to recipe pages. That's more than any other source, if you know how percentages work. But more importantly, it's more than the BBC Food homepage itself. So I ask you, which is the real BBC Food homepage? Is it this one, the one that gets all the UX love? Is it this one? Well, increasingly it's important. Or is it this one? Ooh, controversial. Well, according to the traffic, it is. Perhaps the old rhetoric about your homepage being your most important page is no longer true. According to the traffic, 30% of your effort at best should be spent on your homepage and 70% on your thing pages, because that's where people are coming directly to. Finally, let's look at what's perhaps the standard bearer for domain-driven design at the BBC, and a site whose subject could be said to inherit a domain model and needs more data than even the mighty BBC can provide. Wildlife Finder is a showcase for our world-renowned natural history archive. But far more than being a simple video gallery, it aims to present these clips in a new and useful way to show how the natural world joins up. Informative and educational and entertaining clips have been pulled from thousands of hours of archive footage. But the learning is not just in the clips themselves, but in how the species and adaptations and habitats and ecozones of the world join up. What does the polar bear, for example, share with the barn owl? Well, both are polygynous, which means where the boy polar bear gets lots of girl polar bears, but the girl polar bear can only have one boy polar bear, which is slightly unfortunate. What else is like that? Well, the hippo is like that. The hippo that lives in flooded grassland is herbivorous and is on the vulnerable list. You could lose yourself for hours in user journeys like this, but unlike sites that are just giving you randomly related content, each onward link is actually teaching you a new fact. As you can imagine, the domain model for wildlife is pretty complex, based on the Linnaean taxonomy for biological classification. And while we've got a ton of natural history content, that only really takes care of the video clips. There aren't anywhere teams of elves working away, writing text descriptions for every animal under the sun. Oh, hang on, actually, there are. It's just that they do it on Wikipedia. Yeah, the wildlife team are a big fan of using Wikipedia, and indeed the entire web, as their content management system. Need a description of a hippopotamus? We'll pull it in from Wikipedia. Do some Wikipedia entries suck? Yeah. So edit them on Wikipedia, and that way the whole web can benefit. The program clips in Wildlife Finder are defined as being segments of entire programs, and so it forms a bridge from this domain to the program's domain. But some content we just haven't got. And so that's where we go looking elsewhere. The conservation status for animals actually comes from the University of Michigan, and the distribution data comes from the World Wildlife Fund. And this hints at the power of using linked data, using the entire web as a database from which you can pull bits and pieces of content to plug any holes in your own offering. The animals in Wildlife Finder are, again, the canonical things that can be used like Lego bricks to build cool stuff on top. Big one is curation, which addresses one of the concerns that people have about this domain-driven approach, which is actually how to apply a bit of editorial voice, a human touch, if you will. Curation is put as a layer on top of the resources, and it collects together hand-picked examples of clips and animals and uses them to tell a particular story. Collections add timeliness and context and promotion, and it does so without undermining that structure underneath, but enhances the overall experience. So the success of these projects has changed the way that websites are made at the BBC. From music to solar system to the World Cup and the Olympics and soon to be tackling history, the domain-driven approach means that everything not just links to, but actually seamlessly meshes with everything else. So what then are the things that the BBC are doing that really all of us could do or think about? Well, you can understand, we can all understand, that user experience goes far deeper than presentation. It reaches down through all the layers of the software stack. And as an IA or a UX designer, we have a responsibility to get our hands dirty throughout. Business logic and SEO, pointability, document design, URI design, all of these things have a profound effect on user experience. The approach practiced at the BBC puts IA at the heart of an end-to-end product or service design process. But with great power, as my Uncle Ben once said, comes great responsibility. We can think about the web as a whole and how our contribution can make a difference to it and make it a better place. The World Wide Web didn't evolve by chance. It was designed. Designed by a man who said, its universality is its most important facet. We're supposed to use this space to share information, not to build ourselves ivory towers. So make your stuff easy to share, easy to point at, and convince your bosses, if you need to, of the value that this increased reach will give you. And reap the benefits of shared information. Use open linked data to enhance your product offering. Think bottom up everywhere. Don't start from wireframes. Start from a logical model of your subject. Put most of your effort into your content pages rather than your homepage, because most traffic will come to deep links into your content from Google. Design for your least able user first. Now, that's not just a statement about screen readers. You know, I pretend to care about that kind of accessibility as much as the next guy. But actually, the Google bot and perhaps mobile are your least able users, and also your best friends. So this isn't about throwing a bone to some fringe users. It's about maximizing reach. Make friends with a software engineer. We've heard a lot about coding over the last couple of days. In the advertising industry, great work is done by pairing a creative director with a copywriter. Just think what a dynamic duo, an IA and a coder could be. And prototyping is fine, but the real prototyping tools are not things like Axure and Flash. Think how much more effective your prototypes could be if they're powered by real content and real code, so they can be put in front of real users real fast. Doing it for real isn't really any more expensive or difficult than creating a ton of UX documentation, but it does take new skills. But I believe that investment in skills is far outweighed by the benefits. And I believe, and I hope I'm not alone, that as a community, we need to move on from kitsch user story comics and persona posters if we want to be taken seriously. And that is heartbreaking, I know, because I love making those things myself. More than anything, we need to accept that the web has changed since the days of the polar bear, and some of our practices need to change with it. Of course, we're still about creating the shortest route to content, making things easier to find, and classifying and identifying information. But it's no longer about using taxonomic library science to build a series of private libraries. We need to consider the whole web as our canvas and mesh content seamlessly into it. Design, if you want to think about it this way, design for a world where Google is your homepage, Wikipedia is your CMS, and humans and machines are your users. So in closing, have we gone beyond the polar bear? How do we keep up with a changing web? Yeah, the web has changed from documents to things, people, locations, objects. In some ways, it's going back to its roots, away from corporate silos of information to a shared open network. Today, the public at large are doing your information architecture for you by bookmarking and tagging and socially curating your content. The polar bear asks, does your site need search? Well, 70% of traffic to the BBC Food site is coming from Google, so Google is your search. In some cases, Google's probably your information architecture. Now, finally, I believe there's an elephant in the room. And it's getting bigger. Information architecture, in its core sense, can't get no respect. And I believe it's selling its soul to the technicolor religion of user experience design. We've become known for the quality of our documentation, and we talk introspectively in conferences about abstract processes rather than the actual work that we've actually done. Some places I've been, the IA meetings are held in clandestine priest holes with those people bitching about how they're seen as largely irrelevant in a culture that favors flashy design prototypes or overtly technical engineer-led solutions. But I wonder if it's just a skills gap to be closed. In a web of semantic information, is it less about making those detached deliverables like actual prototypes and wireframes, and more about learning to wrangle information, data, at its source? The UX niceties like curation and seductive interactions and, God help me, gamification can be layered on top. But we have the power to tame the roots and branches of knowledge itself. There are rich social graphs to mine, appetites for infographics and data journalism, and huge repositories of free open data to exploit. And if architecting information isn't a job for an IA, then I don't know what is. But thank you for listening. And a big shout out to Michael Smethers. I'll take some questions if you would like.
First of all, I want to say it was an amazing presentation, and I'm sorry you got, you know, the Sunday morning time slot, but I applaud you for such an excellent presentation.
Thank you very much.
I'm a teacher, for example, and I can't wait to share this with my students. It's phenomenal. But my question has to do with, I don't know, at some point, you know, you're kind of saying, hey, BBC had problems, and then you talk, you know, theoretically about the ideas, you know, not theoretically, well, they're, you know, they looked amazing, and I want to follow up on them. But then it's like, and now we're doing this. But it's that, you know, gap in between where humans are involved, and I'm just always curious about, well, how is it that you actually got humans to, you know, did everyone just throw up their hands and say, we have such a mess, we'll even listen to IAs, or, you know, help us out there with that. Thanks.
Funnily enough, it sort of speaks to the talk I did last time at the IA Summit, which advocated that if you work in a big corporation like the BBC, the only way you can actually get things done is by those kind of small covert teams, we call them the Coalition of the Willing, who are just believe in it enough to become the change agents. Now, fortunately, in the BBC, I mean, there is a huge archive of content to play with. I'm sure we're not alone in that. But the modeling side of it and the sort of the information architecture side of it was done by people who just wanted this to happen. And then once that structure was in place, it was obviously populated with content, as you saw there. But then it was when it was sort of a fait accompli, really, that things were presented to people who were going to have to maintain this with content. The resource was obviously there, and they were working in siloed, bad ways before. So they were very sold on the idea of, you know, a better way of working that would make their jobs easier, you know, as it does, and would make sure that the things that they made actually got more exposure because they were linked to by more things. So it was win-win, I think, for everyone.
Hi there. I just want to say this is my favorite presentation of the summit. Great job. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
But I'm a little bit biased because I'm an SEO. So it occurs to me that when times are tough, as they are now, and we see UX budgets and resources for IA trending downward, the work you've done has ancillary benefits that are measurable for the business. You're driving additional traffic, you're building a brand, your work on structure as exposed through semantic data is, you know, increasing the bottom line. Do you think that there's a business case to be made for IAs and for UX architects to get engaged with SEO?
Absolutely. Let's fast forward 5 years, maybe less. And in that web of semantic information, once our documents are structured properly, we can get computers to do the heavy lifting that we do by hand at the moment. So if you want to say, you know, show me all the Blu-ray players under $70 that are available from people with overnight shipping. Now, you'd have to do that by yourself at the moment, but I would say within 3 to 5 years, you'll be doing that on Google with the same level of precision that you'd be searching, you know, Amazon's advanced search. And then it all becomes about SEO because Google is the aggregator. Google is the front door to all your content. So you need to make sure that it's properly structured so people can find you, because they'll be going to Google, they won't be going to your homepage.
Hi, I also really enjoyed this, and I do this kind of work as well. But what I was curious about was in the Sherlock URL example,
yeah,
you kind of pulled all the semantic information out of the URL, which is bad for Google.
Bad for what, sorry?
Bad for Google.
We don't believe so. The semantic information is submitted to Google through structured XML sitemaps and properly marked up HTML documents. And it seems to be that, I mean, I know in the SEO world, and I hope this isn't controversial to say, that there's a lot of rhetoric about keyword stuffing your URLs. Doesn't seem to make any difference, really. If you've got stuff properly marked up and semantically structured, it doesn't need to be in the URL. And in fact, it's better for Google if your URLs are persistent rather than having something that might have to change over time.
Hi, I also love this talk. I'm with a large healthcare organization. We're also changing our website to go from our organizational structure to more of a semantic model. And my question to you is, how long did this take? Was this a big bang? Was it incremental?
It was incremental because it started sort of as side projects within, and programs was the first big one. Coming up with a domain model and ontology, like as you can see, I mean, it's not going to take very long to come up with something like that. And then the biggest thing, which unfortunately is in the director's cut of this presentation, but I had to chop it out for the 45-minute version, was getting the business data in the right shape. And that's the difficult thing. Coming up with a domain model is relatively straightforward. Getting, you know, your database guru to turn that into a database schema is relatively straightforward. Piping in the content is the hard bit. You might have a lot of business data that's floating around your organization, but it's in the wrong shape or it's designed for internal processes and not for users. So really, that part of it is how long is a piece of string. Programs went live, I guess, about 18 months or so after it was first conceived. But it's been an ongoing process of iterative improvement since then. It's still being added to today. Dwayne, hi.
Hey. Good stuff. I'm curious about the domain model piece of it and the future of it, because what you were presenting there are beautiful, clean domain models. And over time, as they get adopted and accepted, and a lot of enthusiasm comes around it, and then there's a need to change or evolve or adapt one. How do you work a consensus process, or is there a need for a consensus process amongst content owners who are now invested in the domain models as they go forward and evolve?
Often what happens, again, this is in the director's cut, is that the domain model as originally conceived, I'll admit I've shown today some slightly simplified versions of domain models, they're more than you would choose or be able to expose in the first instance. But that's fine. I mean, you might not have all the business data to show certain parts of it, but you can have a more complete model up front and then choose to incrementally expose pieces of it over time, which feels like change, but actually it's change that's sort of planned from the beginning. And yes, I mean, domain models do change and they iterate over time, and then you've got that balancing act. Well, as we saw with programs, as long as you don't build any of that into your URL structure, it's all right, really, because you can adapt to change far better. And with this process, because you're doing it from the data model upwards, everything can change, and those changes bubble upwards.
Thank you. A very powerful presentation. And a question I have is, while I find it impressive how you're leveraging the social power of Wikipedia, it's interesting to me that the model, as articulated, doesn't seem to have a direct social tagging piece, and I know that's a whole nother can of worms, but I wonder if there has been discussion of social indexing, rating, and recommendation aspects.
Yeah. Again, this is an advantage of having that one URL per program, which makes it easy to tweet about, and the BBC have got their own, you know, short URL service that makes it easy to do things like that. I mean, this is just one example. And then we are aggregating back in that social buzz to enhance the program page. So you can see an episode of a show and all the like blog trackbacks and tweets and things that are going on about it. Ratings and recommendation is a whole other topic, but that's something that with the BBC having their site iPlayer, which is like a Hulu type thing, is a big subject for them as well.
I enjoyed it as well, and you might have covered this. I came in a little bit late, but have you had any opportunities for user studies be incorporated into this?
Well, in the sense of sort of qualitative user studies?
Yeah, for example, you're trying to tease out relationships between content. One thing you could do is do something like a version of a card sort, except instead of sorting cards, sorting samples of content, make that a user study and establish things like desire lines between content objects.
When the domain models are drawn up, they're done in collaboration with users because they're there to represent a mental model. And yes, there is, I mean, there is a lot of qualitative traditional user testing done all the way through every development cycle, from creating the kind of rough stub pages to then the sort of more layout and decor enhanced pages. And then after the fact, it's largely about search analytics and traffic studying and those kind of quantitative measures to see what people are looking at. And the BBC have always had a very vociferous community, so people will tell us what they're doing. And actually, in WildlifeFinder, to use one example, it started out, you know, very Linnaean, very kind of film and superclass and all that kind of thing, which wasn't that interesting to people. And so now they've adapted the product, and those things are still there, but they've layered on top more user-friendly things like world maps and this kind of curation that we talked about.
Have you domain modeled all the domain models?
Interesting, there is a project to do just that. What you find in domain modeling is that you'll get to a point, a node or an object, like we saw with the link between programs and music, or indeed wildlife and programs, where two things just intersect. You don't want to recreate or reinvent the wheel or anything. And sometimes it's actually not two BBC domain models, but it's the domain model and some other ontology, like the friend of a friend ontology or something like that, where you've actually got some thinking that's already been done, and you can just pull it in as if it surely as if it were your own. So there are various ways of piecing those jigsaws together.
Any other questions?
Well, thank you all.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2011 IA Summit. For more great user experience design content, visit uie.com and sign up for our free newsletter, UIE Tips.